And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com worldwide. I am going back to the home county and to Ballyhane in County Mayo. Henscake from Ballantubber Abbey of great renown. And I'm going to say hello to Michael Larkin. And Michael Larkin, let me just give you a little bit about Michael is, well, first of all, he is a professional in the field of mental health with the Health Service Executive in Ireland. Better known, mind you, as a writer and an author of his, well, let's take the most recent book, Making the Right Connections. And to bring us a bit closer to the connections not only of County Mayo and Ballyhane, but Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. First of all, let me welcome you there, Michael Larkin. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Good morning, Adrian, and good morning to all your listeners.
Yeah.
And can I take this opportunity, first of all, if I may, to extend from Mayo a very happy Thanksgiving to all you wonderful people throughout the United States of America.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't, you know, I'm sure most people would know that probably one of the holidays that we knock a big long weekend out of course, is the Thanksgiving. The Thanksgiving holiday. And we make it into a weekend, and we're enjoying it, and we have a lot to be thankful for. Let me ask you, Michael, first of all, about your connection. You had a granduncle, and he was among the wave of immigrants, you know, through that through the period. Well, first of all, tell us about Thomas Larkin. Who was he? And he was born in what, 1874?
Ironically enough, on the date, July the 4th, 1874. And of course, July the 4th, as you and your listeners will know, was a very special date in the United States as well. But, yeah, born in the town of Derry, Ballyhane, close to the historic Ballantubber Abbey here in County Mayo, 1874. And similar to thousands and thousands of other young Irish men and women, he made that journey across the Atlantic Ocean as well. Initially, he had travelled to Liverpool, but the promise of better opportunities in the New World, and, of course, his American dream became a reality when he became employed by the Bell Telephone Company in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Most of his career with the Bell Telephone Company in Pittsburgh.
Okay, so obviously, now this is the famine which, you know, wiped out so many rural areas of Ireland, well, almost wiped out, you know, places in, on the west coast, including, you know, County Mayo. The lucky ones during that famine period, of course, made it, you know, to places around the world. You might tell us, fill us in, though, about the relationship between, say, England and Ireland at that point, you know, the empire and, you know, the devastation through their lack of interest and help with respect to the famine victims. Were there people who were leaving Ireland during the famine there that wound up in England as part of the great exodus from the famine period?
There were thousands. And indeed, while there are many stories, as we know, told, of course, from Queenstown, or what is now Cove, in County Cork, on the south coast of Ireland, where thousands of Irish immigrants departed for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no doubt that thousands and thousands more initially would have immigrated to the United Kingdom, be that England, Scotland, or Wales.
Would they have been welcomed? Did they just blend into the UK society? How would they have been perceived as immigrants during that period of time?
In many ways, okay, England or the British Empire at the time, it needed workers, and the Irish navvies, the Irish labourers, they answered that call. But there's no doubt they were second-class citizens, even third-class citizens.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose similar to what we talk about travelling on the ships going across the Atlantic, third-class steerage passengers. So, but it was the strength of the Irish communities then, more than today with our diaspora throughout the world, and in particular in the United States. You know, it was that comradeship, that metal that, you know, kept the Irish together, and there's no doubt that in the UK and in the United States, it played a major role in the building of the both societies that we have today.
Michael, your granduncle Thomas, for pure curiosity, as the immigrants to the United States, during the period and after that period, again coming up to, you know, the turn of the century, how did he wind up in Pittsburgh as, you know, it was a hub of Irish immigrants to begin with. But what drew him to Pittsburgh rather than Philadelphia or New York or, you know, Chicago, the what was then the Irish areas? How did he wind up there?
It was similar to, you know, the thousands of Irish that were arriving on the east coast of the United States. In his case, he arrived at the port of Philadelphia and spent a little time there. But, you know, Philadelphia, similar to New York and Boston, there were so many thousands of immigrants from all over the world, but Irish in particular. And the opportunities that were promised, the posters throughout Ireland and the UK at the time, that promised the great opportunities. Yes, there were great opportunities, but in many cases, how many applicants were there for each particular job that was available? And it was, you know, perhaps by chance that he and some others happened to see that there were opportunities further west in western Pennsylvania. An industry that was literally in its infancy at the time, but the Bell Telephone Company were looking for workers, not in Philadelphia, or they may have been looking for some, but there were more opportunities further west. It's very similar to, you know, the thousands of Irish that immigrated much further west to the copper mines in Montana, for example.
And indeed, the opportunities
were there.
And you know, so many had emigrated now from, indeed, my own parish and neighboring parishes. They had gone to Scranton in Pennsylvania because the coal mines, indeed, was a great place for employment. And they couldn't get enough of them, and indeed, in many cases, we know why. The lifespan was greatly reduced by working in the coal mines there. And of course, as we know, the Irish immigrants, we can claim, you know, built great section of America, the canals, the buildings, the roads, all in actually, predominantly, I should say, in hard labor. First of all, I would say, that the Irish immigrant was welcome. They were there, to work like hell, and they weren't clock watchers. They were distinctive in that they were a good catch. if not socially, as workers. The Irish had a particular reputation in that area.
There's absolutely no doubt that they were welcomed. Some might say it wasn't for the wrong reasons, but they had that strong work ethic, and Thomas Larkin and thousands more from wherever in Ireland, and in particular from the west of Ireland. They had that work ethic, and they were welcomed, be it the coal mining regions or whatever else it might have been. Almost always, in the case of men, it was the manual hard labour of the railroads, and in Thomas Larkin's case, again, the telephone networks. But they certainly were welcome for that reason.
Now, there was this inventor who said, one day every major city in America will have a telephone. And, of course, that was Alexander Bell, and Bell Telephone Company fame. He, at that time, felt that... Well, tell us about the connection between the telegraph and now the talking telegraph, which would become the telephone.
The telegraph, many of your listeners will recall the telegram or the wire, and the Morse code. And, of course, that was in existence prior to the telephone. But, of course, when Alexander Graham Bell, when he felt after long, long time, you know, pursuing his vision, when he felt that it would be possible to transmit the sound of a human voice over a wire as opposed to tapping out the sound, the letters, as in the telegraph. I mean, most people at that time felt that Alexander, that this was absolutely fictitious. It could never happen. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think it was the Boston Post that carried a headline which said, it's impossible to transmit the sound of a human voice over a wire. Even if it were possible, it would be of no practical use. And of course, we can look back now and, well, we know how things have gone now and whatever may happen into the future. But at the time, and even Alexander Bell, as he was traveling throughout the United States, many people and many organizations, you know, it was a real hard sell in the first few years to get the telephone and the, we're talking about the telephone as today, but at that time it was a two-piece item with a mouthpiece and an earpiece.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very rudimentary item at the time. But it took a lot of effort, but, you know, it was perfected and advanced over time.
You know, when the invention was, you know, when that came to the attention of the President of the United States at that time, Rutherford Hayes, he reportedly stated, "This is an amazing invention, Mr. Bell, but who would ever want to use it?" That kind of gives us, a feel of what an amazing invention this was. And I'd say that even Alexander Graham Bell might have himself figured out that, if this could take off in places like Pittsburgh, sure, it could, it could expand from there, but of what commercial use? Like, who's going to pay for this? It was, when you think of it, talk about pie in the sky. This was an amazing, not only invention, but like you say, a very hard sell. Now,
there's no doubt it was a very hard sell. And I believe, at the time, Bell, and probably some of his investors, they were at the point of exhaustion, at the point of almost giving up, traveling throughout the United States, trying to sell this new invention. yeah, business people, and of course it would have been very expensive at the time as well.
Sure.
But, you know, little by little, it gained traction, and it literally took off very suddenly then in the years that followed. But of course, for that to happen, the Bell Telephone Company needed employees, you know, engineers and people of various grades. And it really took off therein. But there's no doubt, Alexander Bell, the brilliant man that he was almost at the point of exhaustion trying to sell. Today we might call it PR, you know, public relations, convincing the public. But it did. And of course, if I, you know, Thomas Larkin in his latter years, and I don't want to jump too far ahead now, but of course, when he was either sending a letter home here to County Mayo, I certainly cannot say on the telephone because there were literally no telephones in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
But when he would be describing or talking even about the telephone, I mean, you know, here in a rural, impoverished West of Ireland, they had little interest in hearing about something that was seemed so far-fetched. And they wouldn't know whether to believe this man or not.
Now, something we don't, you know, bring up too often, but would need to acknowledge is that, you know, we tend to think of immigrants as you know, those coming to America delighted with their Irishness, with their background, with their homeland. But the truth of the matter is that many of them, you know, didn't have much experience in even being outside their own village, their own parish, and then say in rural Ireland. When they came here, they didn't come with stories, you know, of a great Ireland, of one of beauty and one of you know, a land that was, you know, just fantastic. It was many who had come, if there was an exchange of letters, it wasn't indeed all Grand Macree, how lovely everything is, because there was a time lapse, and many of those exchanges, many of those letters were sent, which could take weeks, you know, from the United States to Ireland to announce, you know, that a mother, a father, a member of the family had died. I mean, it's scary to think of it, but not so many of the letters would be letters coming to brag about the New World or you know, anywhere that these immigrants wound up. Tell us roughly, if you will, about the letters, the communication at the time, before the telephone. What was that like?
It was, of course, the handwritten letter, and from the United States in particular. And, of course, how can we ever forget here in Ireland, in the west of Ireland, you know, the strength of our diaspora today and the legacy of our diaspora, the men and women, the young men and women that spent their lives in, let's say, the United States, or indeed throughout North America. But what one of the letters that were perhaps up to 3 weeks crossing the Atlantic Ocean, in many cases, they contain dollars, remittances to, you know, be it to buy the seed, to whatever else it might be here in Ireland. But in many cases, the dollars that were sent from the United States, it was to help pay the fare for a younger sibling to join the brother or sister in the United States. So the letters were so, so welcome. Yes, they would have news of happenings and, you know, in a way it might send out a message of almost jealousy of how, I mean, when I say how good things were in America, they weren't good, certainly not by today's standards, but they were good in the sense that there was plenty of employment and you could make you know, you could make some money, but there were many, many challenges.
So, Tom Larkin arrives in Pittsburgh, and at a time when Pittsburgh was, you know, definitely, it was an Irish hub, an Irish immigrant hub at the time. As a matter of fact, Michael, today 1 in 6 Pittsburghians are Pittsburghans. Although, actually, we have some friends in Pittsburgh, you know, who don't like the title as Pittsburghers to begin with, too close to the hamburger. But anyway, they're great Irish hub in establishing, you know, that great connection and the connection of the Irish and Pittsburgh. You would have to center on, again, now this new gadget which required a hard wire, linesmen. What was the actual process there? How did the, was it overground? Was it underground? How did that come about?
It was overground. But just in relation to Pittsburgh, if I may for a moment, you know, the vast majority of Irish in particular that immigrated there, Pittsburgh and steel are synonymous. Mm-hmm. The glass industry was big there as well. Coal mining, of course, as well. And there were huge opportunities in that regard in the greater Pittsburgh region. In relation to the telephone, ironically enough, the copper wires, much of the copper mm-hmm. that was used in the wires had been coming from Butte, Montana, where thousands of Irish would have been working as well. But it was overground. There would have been some underground, but the vast majority of wires would have been, you know, the telegraph poles and overhead wires. And in fact, I remember seeing an old photograph of New York. My goodness, you know, there were so many cables overhead. Some of them may have been electrical, but a lot were telephone. And it's some sight to see back then.
Yeah, and were they, say, the telephone and the electrical wires, were they kind of, was that the same telephone pole or light pole, or was that different? Did they have to kind of start from scratch?
Well, certainly they had to start from scratch. I mean, from 1876 when you know, the invention of the telephone by Alexander Bell. There would have been some telegraph, you know, poles in that regard. But with the expansion of the telephone from then on, you know, throughout the United States and much more throughout North America, telephone poles were, I'm sure there were lots and lots of forests, you know, to source the telephone poles. So, yeah, they were, and, you know, if we, even today, when we think of pictures, of our images of the American Midwest, you know, hundreds of miles of, be it a highway or not, and the line of, take for example the song, The Wichita Lineman by Glen Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure your listeners are familiar with that particular song, and while it's been relatively recent, but you know, the image of a lineman, you know, looking for any faults on the line in the American Midwest while he would be driving his truck, but again, it's an image of the vastness of the Midwest and traveling through, you know, hundreds of miles looking for faults on the line.
Just so we can, I'm kind of stuck on the significance of the telegraph first. And how available was the telegraph to areas like Pittsburgh? Was that, did you have to go to, as I know that obviously the government had a great you know, reliance on the telegraph, but you wouldn't, You wouldn't have, for instance, from a commercial value, you wouldn't have mid-sized companies using a telegraph. It was mostly connected with an urgency, and an urgency in terms of communications having to do with security, with opportunity, with all of that.
You did have to go on to the post office.
Okay.
Usually to receive the message, which more often than not delivers bad news of the death of somebody or something mm-hmm. else.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was really, and you can, one can imagine here in the remote west of Ireland, you know, messages coming in. So in many yeah. ways, the handwritten letter was so, so welcome because it contained the dollars.
Yeah.
Call it good news. But when we think, for example, depending on how one looks at history, you know, it was as recent as 1950. Now, I know that's not today or yesterday,
yeah.
but it was just, that was when the first transcontinental between New York and San Francisco, that was the first telephone, coast-to-coast telephone call. So, you know, from 1876, while there were many developments, but that was the first call across the entire United States. And indeed, 1927,
mm-hmm.
again, depending on how you look at history, that was the first transatlantic telephone call between New York and London. So, you know, wow. it took quite a while to get the telephone up and running.
All right, now we let's pick it up from where Thomas Locke and your grand uncle. What was his first job? How did he tug out for his first job?
In the Pittsburgh, with the Bell Telephone Company.
Mm. Okay, yeah. So he was a laborer, he was...
Yes. He, you know, he rose through the ranks. Now, there would have been so many layers of, you know, personnel that were needed from all grades. You know, people were needed for the cables, for the telegraph poles, and many, many other areas. So he spent, you see, a lot of this is handed down information.
Mm-hmm.
So he spent quite an amount of his time as a lineman, you know, then becoming a supervisor. And I believe one of the areas that he spent quite a while in that regard in was, we'll say, on the safety. Now, today we talk much about health and safety and everything else.
Yeah.
At the time, you know, there weren't hard hats, and I'm sure the equipment and the clothing used for climbing the poles was nothing like one would have nowadays. And it probably didn't have any hoist either.
Yeah.
But he, you know, had carved out an area and maybe specialized in that area of safety. And I believe he used to say, when he was dealing with rosters or dealing with groups of men at the time, remember, always safety first.
Wow. So he rises through the ranks, and now, by the way, he was single. He never got married.
That's correct.
But here was somebody, and I'm sure one of millions in, you know, who had gone, left the poverty, the devastation of Ireland, and, you know, many of them having lost contact with their families, with their area, many of them having nothing but negative ideas of being forced to emigrate. Was Tom Larkin, was he among those who somewhere in the back of his mind was going through all of this exercise and employment and financial security so he could return to Mayo, to his native county and to his area of birth?
Well, it's like that term, I suppose, divided loyalties. Thomas Larkin, and this seems to be so predominant amongst the Irish in particular, even to this day. Yes, the United States was providing the employment, it was giving the dollars, and the opportunities were there. But that yearning for the homeland, wishing to be at home, and at the same time, that not being realistic, being forced to flee in many cases, particularly in the aftermath of the famine. So it was an unrealistic expectation that you could survive in the Ireland of the time. But that yearning for home was always there. And that was there with Thomas Larkin as well. And ironically enough, similar to, despite the fact that he was involved in the communications at the time, he also lost communication with home, which was very, very common, all too common at the time, particularly amongst men or single men, where, you know, the handwritten letter, it became a kind of a chore after a day's work. But, of course, all that was reestablished at the point of his retirement. And as the story stated in the book, when he, you know, decided to return home and reconnect with his homeland again.
Now, when we think of, you know, those who went to not only America, but to places around the world, and when they did well, and now they have decided to move back to the place of their birth, we think of the great Falcha, that great welcome that they would get. Well, tell us about the stigma of the return Yank to Ireland.
Well, there are many, many stories told, and indeed many examples of the returning American in particular. Yes, they would be seen as being well-to-do in most cases, but, you know, that came at a price. I mean, all those individuals and families that returned to their homeland, whether it was on, you know, a vacation for a week or two or on a more permanent basis, they would have worked hard in whatever area of employment they had. Many times in Ireland that was seen, you know, that this America is so great, there would be the perception that this was the lifestyle they would have all the time. But of course, when one is on vacation and when one is working, it's a little different. In Thomas Larkin's case, because the telephone was a little different, because the telephone was seen as such a foreign object, you know, people didn't really, including his own family, didn't know whether to believe this man or not. When he made some of those predictions and talked about what, one of the things he said, believe me, the day will come and you will be able to see the person he was speaking to on the telephone. You know, in the Ireland or in the Mayo at the time, people weren't really interested in those stories, those tales. They were certainly interested more in survival and just getting on with daily life.
How did Thomas Larkin become such a central figure to the you know, to now, to the what, the AT&T, American Telephone and Telegraph Company? How did he wind up getting such a distinguished, you know, award, as it were, for being among those who, you know, were responsible for not just the creation or being a pioneer in the telephone, but how did he wind up getting, you know, the awards and recognition from AT&T?
Well, call it loyal service, if you so wish. And, you know, perhaps, I mean, I'm not in any way taking away from the thousands of other Irish immigrants who were, be it employed on the railroads, the canals, or whatever else. But there's no doubt that Thomas Larkin was recognised. And I suppose what fascinated me and what probably drove me maybe now to, because I had been this, the memorabilia items that you might refer to there, the recognition, I mean, they had been in the old house since he had returned. And, of course, always as a young person, I was always strongly advise, do not touch. But when I think of the Copper Cup, the certificate he was presented with, and other items that were there, I suppose now I did a little bit of research, and he was held in high esteem. I'm not in any way suggesting that he was at the top tier of AT&T or with the Bell Telephone Company, but by all accounts, amongst his peers and within the Bell Telephone Company, he was held in high esteem.
You, what might have started as an idea and indeed having some great family ties, when you say you did a bit of research, okay, I want to correct you right there. Very few would have indeed into what was, you know, a pioneer territory, you know, come to the United States and go in and not just do research, but actually grab the attention of, you know, of researchers in universities, you know, again, it wasn't confined to Pittsburgh. But boy, you dug into this one big time.
Well, thank you for that. Yes, I suppose I could devote a little bit extra time to doing that now, the interest that I had. And I suppose somebody once said, there is nothing worse than having an untold story within. And when I think of my own parents, grandparents, you know, I had been hearing about Thomas Larkin, you know, for a long, long time. And of course, back then, it really didn't, you know, didn't really appeal to me much at the time. But I suppose on reflection, I felt it's better to write, literally, write something. And I suppose from taking little notes and doing research over a 2 or 3 year period, that's where this kind of came from. And it has now transferred into what is, by all accounts, I hope, a reasonable book.
No, well, you know, I can't let you get away with that either. It's a bestseller. But again, was there a temptation along the way for you to say, geez, this would make a great novel? How difficult was it to stick to and to research and not embellish the story of Thomas Larkin?
Well, you know, most of this is handed down information. Not embellished as far as I'm concerned. I would be the first to say sometimes over time wording can change. But of course it was the memorabilia, which I mentioned earlier, the Copper Cup and the certificates and those. That was more or less the proof of this man's time with the Bell Telephone Company. And, you know, the written words is one thing. Whatever may happen in the future, believe it or not, I have been told many times, the word diaspora, of course, comes to the fore here as well, because it's the connection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the word connection is very apt here in a number of ways. Connectivity with our diaspora. But, of course, most of your listeners will recall, or many of your listeners will recall, that the telephone call, at one time, you had to be connected by the telephone operator.
Mm.
And so word connection is very apt as well here in this context.
Yeah, I'm indeed of the age when we don't have to remember, you know, what happened in the old days, in my days, and long after I left Ireland in 1959, getting a call through to America, you wouldn't want to be in a hurry for that either. You know, it was
and
a process.
The cost of that call at the time as well.
Oh, God, yeah. You know, Anita, I recall that again. Now we're talking about into the 60s and 70s, in connecting with Ireland and connecting with home. You had to go from, you know, one local call to Ballina to then to, you know, to Castlebar, then to Dublin, then to New York. And you didn't stay on the line. You had to be called back and everything. But I do remember that perhaps the only short conversations I ever had with my father was because my mother was, you know, she could pack an awful lot into a short period of time. But the only thing I remember distinctly would be my father saying, "Hello, Adrian, this must be costing you a fortune." Now, and that was it, the awareness that this was such a, you know, an outlandish luxury, particularly if it was just, you know, to make connection and chat. It was not considered to be, the telephone at that time was so expensive, you didn't court it for the, you know, for the crack and say, how, you know, how are things? It was even up to then. So you can imagine if you try to bridge, you know, the time of Thomas Larkin, even to the, you know, even to the 50s or the 40s, 50s, 60s. And that was an amazing amount of progress to begin with, you know.
It certainly was. And, you know, if I can perhaps just lighten this a little bit and bring it up to more recent times, many of your listeners, and you may well have played this particular artist, think of the song by Dr. Hook, Sylvia's Mother. But the reason I mentioned that particular song, you know, remember that line, and the operator says 40 cents more for the next 3 minutes. And, of course, that was exactly the way it was. And there were, when the, at the time, you know, be it a call from the United States to Ireland or wherever it might be, there was a feeling that the operator would listen in on your call and, yeah, and translate that then to the local area here, be that in County Mayo or the west of Ireland, where the local post office or somebody else would know what was being said on the line. And they could do that, but of course they had plenty of work for doing it with other calls also.
So yeah,
there was a strong suspicion and a feeling that the telephone wasn't as reliable as the letter, really.
And again, there was the awareness that you may think that you were making connections with your loved one or for that matter, business calls, you know, and you might as well, you know, have put it in the headline of the newspaper because, again, in terms of privacy, it didn't, just didn't exist. I want to, in your own words, sum up, again, what is a tremendous book, and a great selection, by the way, of photographs of an Ireland that kind of bridges that the last 145 years, and you know the since Thomas Larkin was born, in your own words, what is this book going to do for those who have no Pittsburgh connection, for those indeed who may want to see and get a very clear picture of those who had to immigrate, those who did very well, and you know, those who returned to Ireland, which is an area very specifically addressed in your book?
Well, you know, regardless of whether it's Pittsburgh or anywhere else throughout the United States or indeed North America, I would hope that it encapsulates a lot in relation to Irish-American connectivity, but in particular Irish immigration. And I believe, in relation to the social history of Ireland and the Irish America of the early 1900s, I hope it captures, you know, elements of that as well. In addition to, you know, what was said about the telephone at the time and sure, predictions that were made. So I hope that people will find it interesting.
And I think they will too. Thomas Larkin, you know, an engaging personal journey encompassing Irish immigration, you know, the transatlantic connection and the milestones in the evolution of telecommunications and so much more, thanks to you. Again, Michael Larkin, it's not only a great read, but indeed it's a lovely coffee table book as well. The book, Making the Right Connections, my guest and author, Michael Larkin. Now, what's the best way to get information on this?
The book...
how do we get it? How do we get it from your story to our coffee table?
Well, currently, of course, you know, getting we spoke earlier about the cost of early telephone calls across the Atlantic. I certainly hope it will become more widely available throughout the United States. At the moment, in New York, the Mayo Society of New York has some copies of it.
Yeah.
But if one wants to order a book, www.mayobooks.ie, it's published by Book Hub Publishing. That's bookhubpublishing.com. Or indeed, if you wish to give my own email out afterwards, you can do that to make contact with myself.
Fantastic. That's great. Congratulations on it. And indeed, from a recent former Prime Minister of Ireland, Andy Kenny, I think he may put it best, he says, it's a valuable contribution to the story of Irish immigration and the building of a modern America. Michael Larkin, thanks a lot, and I highly recommend the book again. It's called Making the Right Connection. And if you stay and log on to irishradio.com, we connect you with the website and how you can get one of the greatest books to come out of Ireland. And again, good luck. And thanks a lot, Michael Larkin.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Thank you for your time. It's been my pleasure to have spoken to you and indeed to your listeners as well.
Thank you. And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.